Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this seminar, The Rule of Law as a Disunifying Value in the European Legal Order. It is particularly good of you to be here on a Saturday morning. I will start with just a few introductory words before setting out the plan for the day. So in terms of my own person, my name is Nabil. I serve as a fellow in law at Lucy Cavendish and as an affiliated lecturer at the faculty. I'm also a fellow of the Center for European Legal Studies, which is kindly hosting this seminar. As you may know, the Center for European Legal Studies is a center here at the faculty that exists to promote research and inquiry into the fields related to European law. And it's been a particularly busy and engaged year for the center. We're very happy actually to know that many of you here have also been at other spaces that the center has convened. So why a seminar on the rule of law, and in particular, why a seminar on the potentially disunifying nature of this value? The thinking really began with a deceptively simple insight, which is that members of society do not always agree, hard though it might be to believe that, given what is currently happening in the world. And when they do not agree, when we do not agree, there are really only two avenues out of that conundrum. One is discourse, and the other is violence. But simply saying we believe in discourse and in the power of conversation and in the power of mediating our differences is not sufficient. We need a discourse that in its core is cooperative because, as Jürgen Habermas has said, it makes a difference whether we speak with one another or merely about one another. And in order to ensure that our discourse and our speaking is not merely about one another, but with one another, certain conditions need to be in place. And these are conditions that pertain to the ordering and structuring of society. And that societal system needs to be fair. It needs to be ordered in such a way that it can mediate and channel a diversity of opinions. And this, of course, is where the virtue and power of law comes to the fore. And in order for any system of law to claim legitimacy, it must be recognized to have a number of qualities. And these qualities, of course, are very well known. Qualities in terms of how that law is made, qualities in terms of how that law is enforced, qualities as to the nature of the judiciary, and the principles of independence and impartiality, and of course, qualities or mechanisms in terms of how the law evolves and changes. And this coalesces in the rule of law, because in a very real sense, the rule of law is the exact opposite to the rule of arbitrary power. And indeed, in the literature, you often find that these are two poles on opposite ends in terms of how affairs are organized and how power is exercised. But why do we pose the question of the potential disunifying nature of the rule of law? I mean, surely this sounds like it can only have a unifying effect. And this is because, in keeping with other values, it seems like we are now entering, or maybe have already entered, an era where there are increasing differences in terms of the definition and understanding of values that for a long time were assumed, rightly or wrongly is a different question, to have a shared meaning. And so we can no longer take for granted, again, we leave open whether this is a good or a bad thing, that we necessarily share our understanding when it comes to European values, including the value of the rule of law. And at least in my view, this is more nuanced than might first strike one, because it is very tempting, as I suppose it always is in life, to assume that an aberration from one's own view is the aberration, and that one oneself is not the aberration in terms of what is right and what is wrong. So there might be valid reasons for a degree of divergence. They might be historical, they might be sociological. And this also is why it is really important in society at large, and also we believe in the academy, to ensure that assumptions are continually tested and that this line of exploration and discourse is opened without assuming what the conclusion might be. And at the very least, of course, it calls for reflection on some of these dynamics. And it is also in that spirit and in that vein that it gives me great pleasure to not only invite or welcome you, but also to welcome our speakers for today, who are strategically dotted around the lecture hall. And I will give a more fulsome introduction of each of them in a moment, but suffice it to say, it's really wonderful that Lord Justice Baker is here with us, Professor Catherine Barnard, who, like a student, is hiding out in the last row, and Professor Albertina Alvarez Lorenz. And if you allow, in addition to the more formal professional introduction that I will give, it's also a great personal pleasure to be able to share the podium, I suppose, with all of them, because they are each an inspiration to me in their own way. And I really look forward to hearing their thoughts in a moment or two. But you cannot get rid of me just yet, because I shall also say something about the nature of values. But first, I will share the plan for today. So we will begin by looking at the nature of values in supranational legal orders. Afterwards, we will hear from Lord Justice Baker, who will be speaking to us on the judiciary and the rule of law in Europe. We will then have a coffee break and convene to hear from Professor Barnard on the rule of law and the EU's single market. And then finally, we'll have the pleasure of hearing from Professor Alvarez Lorenz on the topic of enforcing the rule of law as a value under EU law. And with that, and with your permission, I'll now share some thoughts on the nature of values in supranational legal orders. As you will see in the next 15 to 20 minutes, what I will be sharing is not so much an argument or developing a thesis necessarily, but it's much more an offering of reflections on this topic. Towards the end, you might see a small thesis or two crystallizing, but I have tried to resist that as much as possible. And so these thoughts should very much be taken as preambular to the presentations that we are going to hear. And I propose to do so by first taking us through a very brief historical sketch of the nature of values in the European legal order. You will see just how brief that is in a moment. Then consider some of the legal and philosophical perspectives on the nature of values. And finally, take us to some thoughts on the relationship between values and language, and in particular, the limits of language in trying to connote and signify meaning. The first references to values or principles trace back to the 1973 Declaration on European Identity. And of course, the entire declaration is worth reading, but suffice it to say that this is where the language of common values and particular principles first emerge. And this, of course, was at a time when there were 9 members. And as you see also in its opening, the 9 member countries of the European communities has decided that the time has come to draw up a document on the European identity. And this is where we see some of this language. Today, as we will hear also in other presentations, the values are, of course, contained and anchored and enshrined in Article 2 on the Treaty of the European Union, which, for those that are closer to the subject, will, of course, know that this is now one of the most debated and discussed articles of perhaps the entire treaty. And here we read, the Union is founded on the values of respect for human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, and respect for human rights, including the rights of persons belonging to minorities. These values are common to the member states in a society in which pluralism, non-discrimination, tolerance, justice, solidarity, and equality between women and men prevail. Now, although values are relatively new, and certainly new in their expressed form in the Treaty of Lisbon, if we go back into some domestic case law and indeed other international law, we see some earlier references. And I begin by taking you to a case from the Bundesverfassungsgericht of 1958, which is known as the Lüth judgment. And we shall... yes, we shall see that here, as in the case of the international declaration, which I'll take you to in a moment, values are tied very much to fundamental or human rights. Now, this was a rather interesting case. So Mr. Lüth called for a boycott of a film made by Mr. Harlan, a director who had had Nazi connections. Mr. Harlan successfully sued for an injunction to stop this, relying on his rights in private law to be protected from intentional damage caused in a manner offending common decency. Mr. Lüth successfully brought a constitutional complaint before the Constitutional Court to have the injunction set aside, citing his constitutional right to freedom of expression. This gave rise to a question as to the horizontal effect of the constitutional right to freedom of expression. And in deliberating that question, the Bundesverfassungsgericht went on to make what is now a very famous statement, in fact, in German constitutional law. And after setting out the fact that, of course, such rights have a defensive function vis-a-vis the state in a vertical relationship, they then say, and this is why it begins with, it is equally true, however, it is equally true, however, that the basic law, the German Grundgesetz, which does not seek to be a value-neutral order, has also established an objective value system in its section on fundamental rights, and that this is precisely where a fundamental strengthening of the validity of fundamental rights is expressed. This system of values, which has as its center in the human personality and its dignity, freely developing within the social community, must apply as a fundamental constitutional decision to all areas of law, legislation, administration, and jurisprudence, receive guidelines and impetus from it. And this is where then the court develops the concept of what is Ausstrahlwirkung, the radiating effect of these constitutional provisions, which therefore can produce not only vertical effect, but also horizontal effect, but for our purposes, the reference to an objective value system is of note. And of course, in fact, it is so well known that I need hardly spend any time on it, but of course, in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, we also find reference to universal principles and, of course, the story and the history of the Second World War leading to the inception of this declaration is equally well known. And therefore, I move past this and ask a slightly different question, which is, well, what exactly is a value? And the perspective I would like to offer is one that looks at it from a slightly more philosophical and jurisprudential angle. And of course, there is no single answer to this question. It's an inexhaustible list, and it would be my distinct pleasure to take you through every single one that I can think of, but that I'll confine myself to just a couple. And the first is that we see evidence of values being used in a way to signify a teleology. And indeed, in the UN Declaration, we see this very clearly. So this is a kind of Aristotelian concept of the good towards which a society is tending. It may even have a certain asymptotic quality that it approaches but never quite reaches that good. And so it is an orientation which gives order and structure. Indeed, peace and prosperity are values of that kind, signifying the kind of society that we wish to construct. And what is also interesting is that you see references, particularly in some of the documents relating to the Nuremberg trials, that this teleology already exists, that it has been discovered, which of course was very important in order to override the positive law that was, of course, angled in quite a contrary direction. Speaking of which, you therefore see the use of values as a type of anti-positivist counterforce over and above positive law. And in that respect, it suggests that it has a quality almost of sort of natural law quality and certainly sits within what we would call critical morality. And this again, of course, was very clear in the wake of the Second World War in the way that these values were able to trump national sovereignty. And this also had personal impacts. And of course, in Germany, the experience of Gustav Radbruch is relatively famous, that he was pretty much or nearly converted from legal positivism to natural law, after, of course, seeing what a strict adherence to positivism gave rise to. And then you might also consider values as indirect reasons for action, and here you have thinkers such as Raz or Scanlon. And on this view, values such as, say, dignity or equality They're not so much a rule or a fact, but they're a standard for evaluation. So it's a scale within which matters are weighed. And it tells us what is good, it tells us what is important, but it doesn't by itself tell us what we may need to do or how even a court may need to decide in any given situations. And then finally, and this is a topic on which I've written a little bit, I think we can also usefully consider values and compare them to other building blocks in legal codes. For instance, the comparison between values and norms. Now, this view is, of course, not free from criticism, but I believe that you can conceive of a value in comparison to a norm as being of a sort that is inexhaustible in terms of its description. So a value, the moment you can exhaustively describe what that value is, it ceases to be a value and it becomes a norm. So in contrast, a norm sets out the precise, albeit multiple, obligations that can or cannot be complied with. Both of these require interpretation, but the nature of these two are very different. For example, justice is a value precisely because we cannot enumerate all the instances in which justice or a just state is achieved. And something like in the EU treaties, now we go into a very different area, the removal, say, of quantitative restrictions on imports is a norm, which of course requires interpretation. And as all the EU students will know, to understand what is a measure having equivalent effect to quantitative restrictions has exercised the court for a few decades. But in any case, qualitatively, these are rather different. And we are helped, I think, by a perspective from jurisprudence, namely by a perspective from Lon Fuller, who in the first chapter of his book, The Morality of Law, sets up a comparison between the morality of duty and the morality of aspiration. And he defines the morality of duty as the moral minimum that members of society can demand from one another. And so these are obligations such as don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, and they may be enforced against one another. Whereas the morality of aspiration calls upon us to go beyond mere duty and to strive towards moral perfection. Now, we can see how there is a parallel here, that a value might be conceived of as aspirational, whereas a norm can be conceived of as falling within the class of the morality of duty. And one of the things that Fuller warns against is making a classification error and the perils that can flow from not correctly classifying legal obligations as falling within either the morality of duty or the morality of aspiration, and of course famously then develops the principles of legal excellence along the morality of aspiration. And there's a helpful quote from the book and sets up a nice metaphor where he says, the morality of duty may be compared to the rules of grammar, the morality of aspiration to the rules which critics lay down for the attainment of what is sublime and elegant in composition. So you see, there is, of course, this interrelationship, but they sit on different planes, you might say, and kind of has this evaluative dimension to it. And now bringing this contribution to a close, I'd like to share some reflections on values and language, and in particular, the limits of language. In so doing, I will be leaning on the thoughts of a Cambridge local, in fact, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who, of course, was under the tutelage of Sir Bertrand Russell of Trinity College, although later on they had vehement disagreements, so much so that Wittgenstein asked that Bertrand Russell's foreword be taken out of his book because he said that clearly Bertrand Russell didn't understand what he was trying to explain. And what Wittgenstein was interested in, amongst other things, was how not just meaning is constructed, but he was interested in the limits of what language can say. And in fact, his view was that many problems in philosophy are rooted in the fact that we are trying to say the unsayable. And hence his famous dictum in the Tractus, where he writes, everything that can be said clearly. And what we cannot talk about, we must pass over in silence. And I'm just noticing that this version still has the introduction by Bertrand Russell in it, but no doubt you can find an updated one. And this is a very powerful insight, I find, because on this view, so language is capable of representing facts about the world through propositions that then picture a state of affairs. But that gives rise to the question of, well, what happens with ethical and evaluative matters? And do they belong into that same domain? And according to Wittgenstein, they do not, because they cannot be said, but they can be shown. Now, where values exactly fall, of course, is an open question, but at the very least, you might say that they fall somewhere in the boundary of language. And so when a treaty declares that it is founded on the rule of law, on human rights, and on peace and prosperity, is it perhaps an effort to say what can really only be shown as revealed within the ordering and structure of that legal system? And it is a bit like, in fact, other human experiences. Take the quality of love. It is typically, you know, said that love can be said, yes, of course, but it can mainly be shown. And in fact, if it doesn't exist, there are no words in the world that will be able to convince one otherwise. But if you're not the kind of person that likes to show love, but to say that you love, you're in luck because Wittgenstein wrote another book where he modulates his view on language. And he says that, in fact, language is a cooperative enterprise. And there are two quotes in particular that are helpful for us. So he says, for a large class of cases, though not for all, in which we employ the word meaning, it can be defined thus. The meaning of a word is its use in the language. The speaking of language is part of an activity or of a form of life. And to give an example of this, if our meaning is, say, I intend or I mean to do a relatively simple act like open a door, the full extent of what I mean to myself is apparent to me. However, when we enter the world of concepts, and this is why I believe he says for a large number of cases or classes, things are not so simple because it is very difficult for me to see in my mind's eye, in my own sort of language in my mind, the full extent and the reach of that concept. And the way in which clarity emerges is through the interaction and mediation of language. And this is why language is a cooperative enterprise. And indeed, it is the same whether I enter into conversation or whether I write something down. The act of reducing ideas, particularizing ideas into language itself has a clarifying effect, which is why we say the word carries the thought. And a concept like the rule of law is a good example, distributive justice, and the like. If I say I believe in, say, distributive justice, it is only through mediation in conversation and discourse that I myself can understand the full extent of the concept in my mind, because I have not given thought to the full extent before I have articulated it. And there is, therefore, a social dimension, and perhaps most relevantly for present purposes and for the question of the nature and values of the rule of law, perhaps conceptual meaning cannot even be fixed in advance, but must perforce be mediated through a range of legal, political, and social contexts. And on that wonderful indeterminate note, I bring these reflections to an end and say thank you very much indeed for your attention.